Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today I'm excited to talk about local things. I'm excited to talk about justice, maybe, and democracy, and probably a bunch of other stuff as well. Maybe tango. We'll see. Welcome to the podcast, Maria Sachs.
Thank you so much. It's truly, truly a pleasure.
I tend to get the hardest question out of the way to start with. And it's the sort of the very simple and light, easy question around who are you, Maria Sachs?
Wow, who am I? I would say that in a nutshell, I'm a purpose and value-driven nerd. That would be how I would introduce myself or describe myself. And maybe I need to unpack that a bit. I would say that by purpose, I mean that I've been working hard to find my purpose to start with, but also to create a life for myself that enables me to live my purpose. So that's something I'm striving for kind of on a daily basis to stay on the path, let's say. And by value-driven, I've come to really embrace that I'm driven by values. So I'm quite selective with who I'm surrounded with and what kind of context that I show up in, so that I, you know, those contexts enables me also to kind of walk the talk in what I stand for and what I represent. So that's very important for me. And lastly, I would define myself as a nerd, because I embrace knowledge. I so much appreciate to understand how things are connected, to go deeper, to find out, you know, the root causes to certain behaviors or phenomena. And I also appreciate very much to be surrounded by the same. So in a nutshell, I'm a purpose and value-driven nerd.
It's liberating. When you speak to those values, like what are the values that you cherish?
I think integrity is very important to me. And I think that is what I also, when I'm saying I'm a value-driven person, it also means I'm working really hard to have integrity in what I also represent and try to make sure I manifest that in what I do. So integrity is something I appreciate and value very high, also in other people, and in leadership. And if you're a change maker, do you have integrity in what you do? It's very important. Mm. Freedom is another value, to have a free mind, to make sure that I'm like trying to question whether this is my own thoughts or where does my, you know, thinking come from? Do I have a free mind? Can I critically look at things happening around me? And can I live also a free life? And it also, you said we open up with democracy. It also, of course, linked to the freedoms we have and our human rights and all that. So those are some of values I appreciate.
And maybe it's helpful if you would want to take us into what you do.
Right.
Maybe both some history and also like what you do right now.
Right. Well, my background, I started off, maybe I could say I'm Swedish by nationality. I started off after I graduated in the private sector. So for some years, I worked in the bank and finance and a bit of insurance, before I consciously decided to move into the development sector or to work with development issues. So I've been working for NGOs, which stands for non-governmental organizations. So basically the kind of civil society or non-profit sector for quite too many years. And that has been like, I'm super grateful for all that experiences and all, the chance to be paid to make difference, actually, you know, to be able to contribute to positive change in various capacities. So that's what I've been doing, mainly within kind of development of democracy and human rights and equality, and with civil society, to strengthen civil society, to strengthen organization and help mobilizing people for good causes. So that would be my professional background. So I worked for some of the bigger Swedish NGOs, but internationally mainly. And then since about 6 or 7 years, I'm more now an independent change maker. So I act in various capacities. I have that possibility to both work as a consultant, a coach. I'm also founder of an NGO. So I have different platforms to bring about change.
I got curious when you said development, because I know there's also a term that keeps popping up now in different areas where I'm looking, sort of both inner and outer development.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about that term, because for me it's not uncomplicated. It's a tricky.
Term. It is.
How do you think of it, or like educate me?
Yeah. No, thanks for raising that, because it's a quite debated word, and I think it needs a bit of translation for people. It's a lingo within also that sector that I belong to. So people, you know, development is kind of that constant strive to improve on things. But it's what is embedded in the word. It's that it's development can be negative, right? But when we say we strive for development, it's always embedded that it's about fulfillment of human rights. It's about local democracy. It's about freedom. It's about increased gender equality or equity between people. So there is so much values embedded in the word development. In my context, the context I'm operating in. Yeah, so it's and of course then we can speak about economic development, we can talk, you know, development in that context, but this is more like an umbrella word for all these positive change processes.
And I think what I'm coming into in with as well is that this question mark around sort of when do we make positive change? I mean, even positive change is a tricky, like it you start thinking about for whom and from whose perspective, and like what's positive anyways. And I just spent some time at a conference called Local Futures, where one of the originators of that is Helena Norberg Hodge. And she has her story about how she went to Ladakh and she saw sort of how the change makers, or how the developmental agencies, came there with the Western ideal of development. And all of a sudden, you know, it was cheaper to buy the imported butter than the local butter. And like a lot of the local economy kind of collapsed on the back of the quote unquote development, so to say. So it's like, I'm just looking for I don't know how you've seen that, because you've been working on the ground and you've been seeing how development influences different communities. What's your experience?
Yeah, that's, I totally agree with you. And that is kind of the reason why I'm now working more independently, because I felt after all those years in the development sector, sometimes I'm kind of rude and call it industry, because I felt after a while, after all those years, I'm more of an industry. And that is not I agree with you. And that was also at the time, you know, at the same time I started defining myself as an activist, to kind of detach or somehow take another stand than the normal way of doing things. So yes, of course, you know, international cooperation actually emerged and grew out of colonialism. You know, it has a historical roots in something that we definitely don't, or I don't, you know, represent or stand for. So it is a burden of the historical background to it. very, as you said, Eurocentric, or, you know, values that kind of represent and looks at people as undeveloped and the Western world as developed. And with that comes a kind of a top down, or who sets the agenda and all that. So I completely agree with you. And that is a kind of why I nowadays say I'm a value driven, because I was fighting that from within previously. I've always represented another view. And what then caused problems for me was when we were saying that we represented certain values, but we were acting very differently. Like, we didn't walk the talk. And I have been a manager for quite many years, and I'm quite vision-driven person. And then if I have a team, or I'm even driving a whole organization, I need to make sure that what we represent on paper is what we put in practice, right? And when that is not possible, then that causes problem for me. When it comes to these values. So I agree with you. There is, we have challenges to kind of move away from those notions of the Western way of doing things.
So how do you do that? Like, decenter the Western sort of paradigm or culture or whatever. How does one go about to do that in the context where you are?
I use different strategies. I've embraced, I'm an activist. So whatever capacity I show up in, you know, be it consultancy, my consultancy capacity, or my, as a founder of the organization I'm working with, I'm the activist, you know. I don't negotiate my values. And I've strived to become as independent, so I'm not dependent. I can have integrity in everything I do. So I try to show up with my, you know, with my values. And but to answer your question, I have, that's why I founded my own foundation, because I felt like it just must be possible. I really wanted to, I understood it's not easy. I'm humble that walking the talks and engage people in a more respectful and inclusive manner, it's hard work. It's not easy, but at least I will do my very best to try to explore these different approaches that we say that we should work in accordance with. So just to give an example, we commonly talk about that development needs to be community driven, you know, mission driven, bottom up. People themselves should define, you know, their life destinies and how they want to grow their societies. It should not be us Westerners dictating, you know, development and all that. But how do you then put that into practice? And then we might be the ones being privileged to also be exposed to knowledge, technologies, and way of doing things that people not necessarily have access to. So how do you then balance to be a catalyst of change? You kind of introduce new ideas, but you don't own them. You don't drive them until, you know, you could just share and inspire, and then for people to just pick it up. And I think a term that helps a lot. So, because of course you constantly need to kind of scrutinize your motives of doing things, because we are all humans. You know, sometimes my ego comes in the way. And I feel like, wow, now I did things of the wrong reason, because I got just so super excited, you know, let's do it this way, you know, I would love this to happen this way. And it's like, no, but now it's me, you know, it's not the community or the people or the young people we work with that drives this. It's me coming with these crazy ideas. Then I need to kind of stop and ask myself, oh, are we co-creating, or is it me driving this? You know, so It's this beautiful kind of bouncing of ideas and constant questioning on what you do. Be very present and very be there in your whole being. I don't know if that made sense. Quite philosophic answer, I guess.
No, it does. It sets us off in a direction that's interesting. And I love how you were also saying, because one of the things that I've been wrestling with a little bit on this podcast. And as I've been talking to people, and especially like I talk to a lot of change makers, and I find sometimes when we place the word activist in front, then it's very often that we're against something, that we're trying to undo something, or that we're fighting something, or something like that. And I really liked what you said now, because you imbued it with a different meaning than I've seen, but like that you don't negotiate your values and that you're independent. I really appreciate that as a definition, because then you're not, otherwise, you know, that's the trap. I think when we fight something, we get trapped by the logic of the thing we're fighting, because we're trying to do opposite. And so we're still stuck in the same sort of polarity. I just want to double click on that because it's significant. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a very good. I will borrow that definition, because people generally have a very negative notion of activism. So it's good to explain. But for me, it's all about integrity. Once, you know, it's activists for me is people who take action to start with. They not only talk, because we tend to just talk a lot, but we don't, you know, find solutions and put actions on the ground. So that would be one of my definitions. But also, you don't stop, you know, independently if you're paid or not. You know, an activist is driven, self-driven, you know, and you want to see results. So it's not just to be against things. That's right.
I like that. I like that a lot. So I'm also quite curious about, because this notion of democracy and local democracy particularly, maybe, but I mean, in this world where we have so much talk about sort of the house is burning down, you know, everything is inevitable, it's moving so fast, we need large-scale solutions really fast, and like this sort of narrative that I encounter a lot, at least in media and in different channels and in different people as well, for that matter, then it seems futile sometimes to work on the local level. I would say, like, it's like it doesn't feel like the solution, quote unquote, and you know, we can talk about solutions, but the solution is matching the problem or something like that. But how do you see that? How do you parse that puzzle?
Yeah, it's a good question. And of course, there is no easy answer to that. But for me, democracy has flaws, definitely. It's kind of embedded in the democracy to be a tricky concept, because it's all about embracing different perspectives, embracing conflict. Conflict is embedded in democracy in the way, not violent conflict, but to challenge things, to constantly questioning and to allow that questioning. That's part of democracy. And that means it's slow. You know, so what you're saying now, you know, we have that notion that the world is, we are in crisis in very many ways. We have the climate crisis, we have economic crisis, we have now a lot of conflicts and a lot of also polarization. And, you know, in modern times, we haven't had this many authoritarian regimes as we have. So kind of democracy is going backwards, and that's another kind of crisis. So, but I see as a danger that, because it's part also of the kind of far-right propaganda or populistic agenda to also reinforce the fear and reinforce the urgency of things, to kind of excuse certain policies that would not be, you know, respecting democratic values. And I see that a lot of that kind of propaganda to make people think we are, you know, this urgency and crisis, so we should sidestep the fundamental values of rule of law and, you know, the slowness that comes with democracy. And in many cases, it's not as urgent as we are kind of told. So I see a danger of that, because we speed and take shortcuts and sidestep really fundamental way of doing things democratically does not necessarily lead to a better future and a better way of addressing the challenges we are standing, you know, or the challenges with at the global level or regional or local.
Do you have any examples or like something to ground it in, like where these complexities come into play to deal with something concrete? I don't know if that's possible. That might be too hard of a question.
let me think of something. I risk to get into politics if you get me started on that one. But we have, for example, in Sweden, currently we have a lot of violence, very, very unfortunate, very, very disturbing development in our suburbs with a lot of shootings, a lot of gang violence that has been kind of alien for the Swedish society before. So we are kind of shocked how rapid that development have gone. And then there is, you know, very different schools and ideas of how to address this. One is there is no shortcuts. We know research tells us that it doesn't help to increase, you know, court sentences and send young people into prison or have more police and all that. We need to work with inclusion. We need to improve our quality of the schooling programs and make sure people feel part of something bigger. And that takes time. So now we have a lot of policies put in place or decisions or reforms that are kind of trying to address the urgency of this, or the perceived urgencies, which I think will not actually address the real root causes to this violence.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's an example, but we need complex problems needs to be addressed holistically. There is no shortcuts.
No. And maybe that's kind of an example of what you're talking about in terms of integrity as well, that there is a difference between looking good, trying to look like you're addressing a problem or actually getting at it, or like if you actually care about the causes of the problem and you... Because you don't have to go very far, and I'm definitely concerned about the developments in Sweden myself as well. So that's probably my bias, I should say. But at the same time, I really think you don't have to go very far to see the data and the statistics and the science on that more control and rougher going at it, confronting it, like fire, meeting fire with fire isn't really that's usually doesn't end well.
No.
But I'm curious about, I don't know, I'm trying to like, there's something here, because I know my own, just to give a bit of context from where this question comes from, that, I mean, I have a business background, and I've worked in companies my entire career, basically. And at the same time, I've had a window into the public sector because my sister is working. She's working at the UN, and now she's working at CEDA. So she's taken a different route. And we've had these sort of, well, I would call them arguments over the past maybe 10 or 12 years or so, like since she started engaging professionally about how the world works and like what's a good intervention and like how does it work and what's better. And I have to confess that I was quite arrogant in terms of or critical towards the efficiency of these large institutions sometimes. And I think maybe even now I feel that sometimes that critique is warranted for. But at the same time, beginning to understand this sort of whole different set of theory around sort of sociology or anthropology and like all of those things to complement my skills or my knowledge within the economic realm has been extremely important for me to understand actually what she's talking about. Like that like you're speaking to, like the slowness can be a feature. It might not have to be a bug, and that what it seems like might not be the way that it is, and like all of these things. And it doesn't have to do in these sort of simple divides in terms of like, oh, do you want to go soft? Do you want to go soft? You want to coddle these criminals or like all of those things? Like that's not really helpful story, or like that's not a helpful way of addressing these issues. So I'm wondering if there's something here that I'm like looking for, where I know, or like I believe that you have experience in that I would love to be able to sort of communicate, but I don't really know how to get at it. So how did you, because you've started in business as well, like how did your perspective shift, or like how did you move into this more activist mindset, the way that you're defining it?
Right. Oh, that's an interesting, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure, you know, I have the full answer to that, but definitely something I've explored a lot throughout my whole career. As you said, I started with the private sector with, you know, I grew up in a family that equipped me with certain values and openness for the world and so on. So I brought, of course, that I showed up also in the private sector with that, those kind of values. But I appreciate a lot the efficiency you know, in business, you are very result oriented. You know where you're heading, and you're measuring, you know, your success based on if you, you know, achieve and so on. And that kind of energy I brought into the, when I then shifted completely and started working in the nonprofit sector or civil society sector, then I felt like I felt that I was a bit different in my way of doing things. And I think that was my main contribution, that we can't just do things out of doing things. We need to make sure that we actually have impact. So I try to bring those tools and methods and approaches from the private sector and introduce them in the civil society, but at the same time, take the beauty of the civil society, the values and the way you do things. And try to move away from the kind of top down or we have the solution kind of thinking. I try to basically try to merge the best of those two worlds. And that is still my change theory, that both are kind of needed. And I would say that the civil society has adopted a lot from the private sector. Through my career in the beginning when I started, we didn't talk much about result-based management, as we call it. That's just a nice word for, you know, making sure you have clear objectives and that you make sure you reach those and you evaluate if you're, you know, not reaching your results. So we have, I think we have learned a lot from the private sector. Basically, I don't see it's beneficial for us to even divide it. And I think that is now what I do. I work a lot with the private sector, and I'm running my own business, for example. And it's all, I have never seen a contradiction. I think that is another conversation, because when I've never seen a contradiction of being, you know, running a private business and contribute to social change. It shouldn't be, according to me. It shouldn't be. And of course, if you're just there to satisfy your shareholders and this with growth and all that, then you have a problem. But in fact, businesses are supposed to address needs and in the society, be it for people or planet or something. And if you just keep that, then you can't fail people and the planet. You will contribute to something positive and you can still do profit. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think, you know, the values could be the same. You just need to embed that into your business idea. That's the way forward.
But it's a little bit like the devil's in the details, I find. Because, I mean, one of the things that, and I'm leading you into tricky territory here, but let's see, you can opt out. but I also see that from my perspective, it seems like some of the sort of the businessification or something like that, or like this religious following of results and goals and measuring and sort of almost this neoclassical sort of trap of believing that anything, like unless we can put a monetary value on it, or unless we can put a value on it, a number on it, it didn't happen. Like it's almost as if, you know, if a tree fell in the wood and you couldn't measure it, like, then it didn't happen. It didn't fall. Like, and so there's something around the focus in the private sector on measurement, on impact. Impact is a tricky word, I think, even. Is that really what we want? Like, I don't know if impact is sort of the right, does it lead the so I'm just like trying to get into the granularity here of like, because there's a trap in measuring as well. Like it does direct our attention, and what we put our attention on is what we value in a way. And the values are, as you're mentioning, they're central. So there is a way that we can break up maybe the single-minded business logic on profit. And I think that seems to be happening more and more again. And I think also like maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago, it seems like business was in more disparate, more diverse, so to say. And then you had sort of this whole Milton Friedman thing of like that the only thing that a business should do is the one own thing is to provide shareholder value. And that seemed to have shifted something. I mean, not that alone, of course, but like the whole system around it. I'm just wondering, I'm wrestling with these terms like efficiency and so forth. And like, how do we know what's efficient? And like in a different community, in a different culture, you know, efficiency might look very different than sort of the modern colonialist Western notion of efficiency. So I don't know if you want to tangle with those, like, what do you think of that?
I mean, it's very interesting questions. And just to give you an example of how I've been working, because I've had the privilege to or honor to work, to have positions that I was in charge of impact and quality insurance, for example, in a, you know, an organization, and in charge of the capacity and method development and all that, where you work with the systems or methods and approaches that is needed to bring about change, to have impact, if to use that word. And then I have had, you know, colleagues that are kind of bringing this up, like, oh, but we can't become obsessed with results, like the way the private sector is obsessed with, you know, and measure, and we spend so much time measuring. And yes, so you need to find a balance, you know, there needs to be a balance between how much we are, you know, measuring and make analysis and processing and what we put in action. That's, for me, is very important. It should be the majority of things we should try out, explore, and put things in practice, and then we should follow it up. It should not be the other way around. So that is one perspective. But my argument has always been, we then misuse, let's put it, the result-based management, because we don't need to measure maybe cost effectiveness or these things. We can as well measure the degree people feel ownership, the degree people feel included and empowered, and they have the power to bring about change. That's and it's a result. Mm-hmm. So it's just about the quality and how we define what change we want to contribute to. And then we need to be good at knowing that we're doing the right thing. So that is not, you know, built on our own assumptions or perceptions that is not shared, you know, with. So, yeah, I think for me that is not the approach that is necessarily the wrong, but we need to really be careful in how we define our result and what is success and so forth.
Yeah. I think that's sense? So important, because what you're speaking to now for me, yes, it makes sense. And I think that is, again, sort of that difference in terms of starting point, that whereas like if you have more of the messy stuff, like the human stuff, if you have that more, if you're more grounded or connected with that science, you will be able to do what you're speaking of. Whereas when we are looking at impact investment, for instance, you know, or like the sort of impact philanthropy a la Bill Gates or whoever it might be, I think those people that come solely from the business world, I mean, and I, you know, that this is, but we have a different value of it. And there's a hierarchy of values as well, in terms of, you know, monetary profit is sort of the main one, or like the amount of mosquito nets or vaccines or whatever it is, that's the measure that we count the hardest, because the other stuff is the soft stuff. But if we don't, we have to sort of question maybe that hierarchy of needs. And of course, I'm being very general now, and it's not going to be true. There's a lot of nuance in all of these initiatives, yeah. And I know that. But there's a certain way that I feel that impact investing could learn something from the professionals.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. No, we share that observation, I would say. I mean, if to look at the trends, there's always trends, you know. We come from a background. I mean, the whole civil society or international community, or how I don't know which word to summarize, but you know, all actors, you know, there to somehow, you know, improve people's lives, to make it simple. We come from where we had a lot of program. We should modernize. I mean, historically, the Western world, or you know, try to help underdeveloped countries and all that. Very result in we drill, you know, boreholes, or you know, provide water and all that. And then we realized that mm-hmm. didn't bring about change. So then we spend a lot of time thinking through how to do it properly. And we say that we need to work right-based. We need to really think through how people co-create, and they are part of their own development. And we need to set structures, democratic structures in place for people to hold their you know, decision makers accountable, and to know their own rights and all that. Should not be someone coming from outside to fulfill people's needs and rights. That's not sustainable. So there is so much learnings, but of some reason now we move back, but we just phrase it differently. We talk about climate finance, mm-hmm. impact funds, innovation, and we think technology will solve everything now. And I see a big risk that we are now moving back, and that slowness that we talked about earlier is now not as appreciated, because it's kind of, goes too slow, and there's a lot of, you know, innovative people coming in with a lot of technical solutions, which is brilliant. We need that, but we can't ignore the need for that slowness somehow. Again, kind of philosophic, but I share that kind of, you know, at least a worry or concern.
And I think also there's a risk when we take, I know that one of the people that it's also philosophic, but one of the people that I follow and listen to a lot is Nora Bateson. And she speaks of this importance of words. And the way that I hear you using impact, for instance, is quite different actually from the word impact used in maybe venture capital circles, or like impact investing, or like these things are not always, because there are a lot of people that have, you know, but often we're using these words mean different things, and they are imbued with different things. So it's important to keep track a little bit and look at the underlying, what's underneath the shiny surface of that word. I want to talk about tango.
Oh.
Because we kind of touched upon that.
Yes.
Last time. But maybe even here, it has some relevance. Because it's like these. Now we've talked about something quite heavy in a way, and maybe heady even. And yet I think that for myself, at least, I don't do the tango. I've never, but I've done a lot of dancing in my life, and I'm now doing sort of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, which is really informing how I think and how I act and move in the world, actually. Mm-hmm. And I see that it has relevance, has so much relevance to especially all of these complex and tangled topics, because there's like a different way of understanding them, because dancing is inherently complex as well. So I don't know, like how does your tangoing inform, or how has it informed your work? It's just a small jump.
but very interlinked, as you say. Thank you for that. I love tango. This saying, it takes two to tango. You know, I've never really understood that more than, you know, yes, you are two people dancing. It's kind of obvious, you know, it takes two to tango. But it was not until I took my first tango lesson that I realized what is really the meaning of that. And yes, it does inform the way I think we should interact and kind of co-create and go about our life and our relationships a lot. Because, yeah, maybe to explain for listeners who have not danced tango, I think what makes tango a little bit different from some of the other kind of classic dance styles is that you walk kind of straight. So if your dance partner, you know, start walking without you being, you know, knowing where you're heading, he will step your toes. It's so obvious in tango because you kind of, it's not like you go side, you know, you don't go side to side, you kind of go straight, you know. So it's all about communication. That was what I learned. Tango is communication. And what is the beauty? You don't speak. You just need to feel the other person, feel the energy, feel the balance of that person. And you need to make sure that you feel that person before you take your move. And I need to follow, in my case, I'm a woman, so usually, unfortunately, there is some room for women also take lead in tango, which I appreciate, making more equal in a way. But anyway, the classic is that I'm the follower, so I need to follow and I need to, you know, feel the other person. I need to act, you know, based on someone taking lead. So it's so much around that communication that you can apply in real life. And that I am applying a lot in my work that I do. I mean, I've not shared much, but I do work in informal settlements in Kenya, which is not my own society. So how do I do that in a very respectful way? I will use the word impactful way. I can't be there, and I shouldn't be there if I'm not dancing tango. I'm not co-creating. And I have that respect in listening and not take a move until I know that we are together. So that's tango.
How do you know that you are together?
You sense it. You need to show up with your full being, not with your ego. And that is kind of how I try to live my life. And that kind of require a peaceful mind to know that I'm sensing things rather than thinking. And then it's possible. Because there was a time that I actually took a total year off because I felt like, no, I can't work with these things because I'm this white privileged person, you know. I don't have the right. I can't speak on somebody's behalf. I can't do this. It's not up to me to change, you know, people's lives and so on. And that's like, no, but that's, as an activist, I do see things. I see justice and I just want to make a difference, but it's the way I do it. It's the way I show up that matters. Not that I'm white, not that I'm European, not that I'm like, you know, well-educated. It doesn't matter if I'm just showing up in a respectful and co-creative way. So it is possible, but it's hard, but it's possible. The tango way.
Do you want to say something more about the projects that you are working with at the moment? Like what is it that you're aiming to do and how? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm happy to share that. It's what I'm most passionate about, and I would say maybe I've engaged myself in the most impossible thing, almost. It just happened to be that I was in Kenya about 6-7 years ago, and I was invited. I had the chance to visit one of the informal settlements, commonly called slums, but we try to avoid that because it has so many negative quotations. Mm. But it's informal settlements, so they're unplanned. You know, there is no city planners and so on, and they grow based on urbanization, people moving into the cities and hoping to get jobs and so on. And Nairobi, where we work, has about 180 of such informal settlements with different sizes. So the majority of the residents in Nairobi actually live in such settlements. So I founded an organization called Voices for Change in 2016. And we started working in Kenya in 2019. And I've tried to develop that organization or design it in a way so I can walk the talk with my values as we have spoken of. So Voices for Change is not an organization with its own programs implementing things the classic way. We define ourselves as a platform, as an enabler. We are careful that we are not coming with our own predetermined agenda, but rather amplifying voices, and voices in a metaphorical meaning. You know, people's own, we just want to enable and amplify people's voices and make them, help them to be heard, basically. And that could be through theater, it could be through music, it could be advocacy work, trying to push for certain policies, various ways, depending on where the groups and young people in particularly, you know, where the energy is, or their different missions. So that's what we do. And then we also, so we work with young people. We started off working with hip-hoppers and rappers in those communities, because In the one that where we started working is called Dandora, and it's the birthplace of Kenyan political rap. And this is the conscious rap where you use music to address social justice and real issues in the communities. And it resonates very well with other young people and children. So they learn things through the lyrics and the rhyme. So it's a very actually effective way to reach other young people with good messages. Now we talk about good messages. So that's how we started. And now we are also running an initiative called Growth for Change, because we came to realize that we can't just work with voices. People, you know, might eat just once a day. So food insecurity is a huge problem, a huge challenge in these communities. So we introduced hydroponics because people grow food just next to a dump site. So Dandora is the location for Nairobi's biggest dump site. It's enormous. It's absolutely it just grows. There's no kind of measures put together to prevent, you know, that toxicity to reach water and the ground and so on. So people kind of both live on the dump site and from the dump site. And it causes a lot of environmental and human rights hazards. So we notice that people grow food out of desperation, just completely, you know, in the ground. And of course, it's not safe for human consumption. So then we introduced hydroponics technology, which is about growing in kind of pipes to make it, describe it easy, simple. It's a technique, mm-hmm. how you grow food out, off the ground, basically. There's different designs. But the good thing is it's good when the water is scarce, when space is scarce. So people are living, you know, very squeezed, but at least they have maybe a wall. So you can put up pipes up the wall. You can have quite many plants in a very small space, basically. So it serves this community. Of course, it's not a solution, because ultimately we clean the soil and we, you know, work with other ways. But this is it's a good technology to enable people to grow food for themselves. So we have this ecosystem. And again, our approach, our change theory is not to run own programs the way organizations normally do, but we try to just build up like an ecosystem of urban farmers, of environmental activists, of groups, and we just try to tap into the momentum or the energy. What are they working on? How can we just enable what they do? So we work very organically and try to be responding to their requests and their needs and co-create change, basically. So, yeah, that is what we do.
Yeah, fascinating. And I just got curious about the food. As people grow food, is it for their own use then? Or is it also, like, are there also sort of business models in terms of, like, earnings related to the food growing? Or is that...
Yes. Yeah, it is. No, we have an entrepreneurial approach. Like, we really encourage people to set their set up their farms or their systems as small micro businesses to become independent. And that's what people really strive for, because the unemployment is super high in these areas. They're really struggling. And what is good with hydroponics is that it's not like it doesn't take up that much labor work, like hours. You can just, as long as you are keen checking in, you know, certain things, you can, you know, pay about an hour per day. And then during the day, you can do other stuff. So in that sense, it's good. And then you can sell the surplus. So yes, we are encouraging and we're trying to help them to set up small businesses. And so they can both grow for their own. It depends on the group. I mean, some you know, community-based organizations, they are having feeding programs for kids, and they are very keen that they grow food and they can feed both their own children and children in the communities. Others want to make a living, you know, and are more focused on running it as a business. So we also, again, listening, what kind of organization is this? What is their mission? And how can we set up a system that, you know, supports their own ideas, aspirations? But that with entrepreneurial is very important, and what people are really looking for. They don't want to be dependent. They know they are survivors. They need to find means to make a living.
I don't know how to ask this question respectfully. any myths that you would like to dispel of them, of the others, those over there that are like any things that you've learned being in these environments and working that you would like to kind of, any myths or like beliefs that you see or the common myths from people that haven't, that you would like to dispel?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, so many. I mean, to be very, very honest, starting working there completely healed me. It healed me. It changed my life completely. I had started becoming quite cynical after working in the NGO sector, because there are so many organizations out there that are, and not necessarily because they are bad people. It's just that industry kind of reinforces, or that kind of donor-driven approach. You know, we do whatever you bring the money and we will deliver, right? Because it's a way of making a living and so on. They become detached from their communities. But starting working in these areas, they're young people. So to start with, they just speak their mind. They told me upfront what they thought. They had integrity, you know. So I immediately fell in love with these young people, because it was so refreshing to get that honest opinion about development, about NGOs, about white people, about our approaches upfront. And instead of, you know, I getting, you know, scared of that, I really just became, oh, this is so refreshing. I want to work with these young people. I think this is a foundation to really make a difference if we could just accept and start, you know, then trusting each other. So for me, these young people in these communities have an integrity that I was like really amazed by. The myth would be they they are known as ghettos. They shouldn't even, you know, name themselves that we are part of ghettos. And they are like embracing that and they're turning that into their identities. And that ghetto mentality, of course, has both positive and negative sides. But that honesty and wanting to develop their own communities, this is what really amazed me when I came. Because people, the notion about people living in those is they're uneducated, they're criminals. You know, there is so much stigma surrounding people living in those communities. And that was not what I experienced when I came. There were so many different groups that have registered. They are cleaning rivers. They are planting trees. They are feeding kids. They are fighting domestic violence. And I came with that, my old notion, and I started asking them, like, oh, who founded you? Where do you get your finances? Who is working with you? And I expected some in a Western NGO. And they were like, what are you talking about? We have registered this organization to change our community. We can't sit and wait for someone to help us. It's us that wants to transform our own communities. And I was like, wow, they are such survivors, and that energy and that those skills and commitment was so fantastic to come across. So I'm super humble for have gained that trust to be in those communities. It took a long time, I can tell you. I had to be there for about a year just to be trusted. I didn't bring any money. I was just there, and they kind of, oh, this woman, she shows up again and again and again. She doesn't, you know, I spend a lot of time, and they were like, oh, there's something wrong with her. But anyway, we got to really establish that trust. And then now we can really, really, truly work together. So there is so many myths, and also not just, among foreigners, but also Nairobians. They don't even go there. They think, you know, even the, you know, sometimes I take a taxi, an Uber to get there, and they are scared of entering the areas. And I was like, but I'm a Masungo, a white person. I'm a Masungo, you know, I work there. Please bring me, you know, if I dare to go there, I think you will be fine, you know. So, yeah, there is so many myths surrounding. And of course, that's prevent. They can, you know, have that ghetto mentality, that self-confidence when they are in their safe space, when they are in the areas. But if they are then invited to do a interview in the city, you know, they are then perceived as criminals. So they have a lot of barriers to overcome.
I have much more to ask about, but maybe it's a good, I'm also looking at the time, and maybe it's a good pause point. Is there something that I should have asked about that I didn't, or something else that you'd want to kind of bring in that we missed?
Not really, but I think what I've come to realize now when I'm currently in Sweden, and that approach, that, like, I think what the theme of our conversation have been very much about how you bring about change, you know, what the values and approach and all that. And I would say this is very much universal. And now addressing these challenges in the suburbs that we were talking about a little bit, you know, here in Sweden, it's the same way, the tango approach. Maybe we have come up with a new way of describing it. But I would say that, and also what you said with the businesses and so on, I think if you have that mindset, that respectful, co-creating mindset, you will achieve so much more than the kind of traditional way of doing things. So for me, I just want to summarize with that. It's so important, and to just allow things to emerge. Don't come with an agenda. Just, you know, be brave and bold to listen and co-create with people in a respectful way. Then you can't fail.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. And if people want to work with you or help or contribute to any of your projects or some, where would you direct them? Where can they find out more?
We are on social media, of course. It's Voices for Change and Growth for Change. That's our, like, both our channels. We have a website, voicesforchange.se. You can find out more. It's currently down. We are doing some constructions, but that is where to find us. I'm on LinkedIn, of course. People are very welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn and connect to co-create. We are very, very open for that. And businesses that have, you know, environmental sound technologies and would be interested and willing to adopt them into, you know, these communities where we work. We say we work according to ghetto engineering. So it's all about adopting it to local conditions. Mm. So if they want their technology to be ghetto engineered to really make a difference in communities, I'm very welcome to connect.
Great. I will put the links as well in the show notes so you can kind of just go there and click if this calls to you. Maria, thank you so much for taking the time. I really, really appreciate this conversation. And it was wonderful to meet you like this.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much. Beautiful morning conversation.